We are live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, September 27th, 2017. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we'll learn about the Vision Board Workshop with guest Christina Michelle. Hal Geiger will be here to discuss end-of-life culture in an upcoming author's talk. Kevin Meyer will be here to tell us about the Salmon Social. We'll get a preview of Skagway Burlesque and find out more about the new sculptures going up on the waterfront. So those interviews and National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Weather for the rest of today, rain, maybe heavy at times. Significant rises expected on area rivers and streams through tonight. Tomorrow, rain likely, highs in the mid-50s. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. New Mexico U.S. Senator Tom Udall advocated for health care for people in Indian country on the Senate floor Tuesday. The vice chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs says efforts by Republicans to dismantle the Affordable Care Act would devastate Indian country. Udall says repeal of the act and Medicaid expansion would violate the government's trust responsibility to tribes. He was among two other Democratic senators on the Indian Affairs Committee who gave back-to-back speeches about protecting and improving health care for Native Americans. Republicans pulled the plug on repeal efforts this week. Udall says, well, that's good news. He will stay vigilant on the issue. Brown University and a group of people who are occupying land owned by the college claiming it's their ancestral Pokanoket territory have reached an agreement. An encampment was set up in August on the university's property in Bristol, Rhode Island. According to Brown University, an agreement was reached last week, which acknowledges tribal historic ties and cultural history of the property. It outlines a plan for a portion of the land to be transferred into a preservation trust for conservation and for tribes in the region to access the area. People occupying the land ended their occupation this week. The agreement was made after a series of meetings between people at the camp and university officials. There's no official timetable for the trust to be formed. The National Congress of American Indians recently formed an alliance with the immigrant organization Define American. The groups hosted an event this month in Washington, D.C. titled First Americans and New Americans, which focused on laws, culture, identity, and citizenship. Brian Cladisby is president of the National Congress of American Indians. He says one of the topics discussed was President Trump's move to end DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy to protect immigrants from deportation.
We just want to advocate with them on the importance of really looking at this issue closely, not penalizing these kids who were brought here as children, but to look at them as productive members of society, many of them working, many of them in college, many of them with families, and to look at their contributions and to overcome the myths and the stereotypes that all they are is rapists and drug dealers and that they've got massive calves because they walk across the desert carrying drugs. And so we want to work with them to try to overcome the misconceptions and see how collectively our voice can be heard out there.
This was the first such event hosted by the groups. Leaders committed to working together on educating the public about their issues, including concerns about the border wall and the farm bill, which leaders say impact both Indian country and the immigrant community. Some tribes in the Northwest have received more than $1 million from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, it's part of a larger award to benefit tribes nationwide.
Kelly Rao is Executive Director of Health Services for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. She says they received $500,000 to construct a 1,900-square-foot addition to their health and wellness center.
Since 2016, we've doubled our size for alcohol and drug abuse support groups, and we've come up against not having enough space to be able to do additional groups. We want to protect people's privacy and confidentiality, and so we're excited because this is going to give us an opportunity to do that.
Rao adds 71% of tribal members surveyed in 2015 said drug abuse was their greatest concern for public safety. The Burns Paiute tribe got $340,000 that'll be used for low-rent housing. The Klamath tribes got $275,000 to help build a community fitness center. Altogether, 77 tribal organizations receive more than $55 million from HUD's Indian Community Development Block Grant Program. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and with me is my first guest, Kevin Meyer, professor of English at UAS and Alaskan Salmon Fellow. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're the first Salmon Fellow I've ever met. What does it mean to be an Alaskan Salmon Fellow?
Yeah, great question. We're working that out, kind of, and we're about to get more details on it next week. But it's an Alaska Humanities Forum program, and about 6 months ago, 15 people from around the state were selected, and we applied and were selected, and we're trying to find ways to create a more equitable and sustainable salmon system. So there are representatives from all the different regions, all kinds of different user groups, and we've met once in Kenai, and we're about to go to Igiagik in Bristol Bay next week, and we'll find out more about what it means to be an Alaska Salmon Fellow.
Interesting. And you're a part of the Alaska Humanities Forum?
Yeah, so it's a program that's sponsored by the Alaska Humanities Forum. It's kind of a leadership initiative, the Salmon Fellows Project is. But yeah, that's the main funding source.
And how do you like being a fellow so far?
It's been really interesting. I work in the humanities, and so I'm not the first person that, like, a radio reporter or a newspaper reporter would call to ask about environmental issues. And so, but I do think that the humanities have a lot to offer in terms of telling the right story or attending to the way that language matters and these kinds of decisions. So it's been fun. I've been afforded a little bit more sort of publicity and authority in that way.
And you've got a great platform here on a Juno
Afternoon. Here we are.
Great. So you're here today to talk about the Salmon Social. This is where the fish get up and dance with you.
Exactly. In a Ray Troll kind of way.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Yes. Now I have a whole vision.
Yeah.
No, please tell us more about it.
Yeah. So this is part of, I teach English. I teach environmental humanities at UAS. And we have a really super active student sustainability club. Unfortunately, the student who was going to come with me today has the flu, so she couldn't make it. But they're trying to get events on campus to get students thinking about food this year in particular. They're trying to start a garden, trying to work on composting, been working on recycling, just to raise the student level of awareness of sustainability issues. And so I went to them and thought, well, let's have some sort of salmon-oriented kickoff event where they can recruit members and we can bring the community in to think about how Juno is already doing local food really well. Mm-hmm. So what we've kind of envisioned here is we're calling it a salmon social, and I'm going to provide a little bit of smoked salmon and make a couple potluck dishes. We're asking other people to bring food and trying to really riff on or think about the local foods, right? Like, what are the things that we can produce and grow and harvest here and eat that make this place a really wonderful place to live?
I think most people are pretty aware of the fish that you can catch and the berries that you can pick. Do you expect anyone to bring anything a little bit more unusual than that?
I don't know. We have students from all over the state, and they were pretty excited. So a lot of especially rural students travel with their traditional foods. So at the meeting earlier this week, wheels were turning. So I don't know what will actually show up. But there's really fantastic cooks on campus that might bring out some cool things.
And what's the most unusual Alaskan-grown food that you've ever eaten?
Oh, good question. I still think beech asparagus is the most exotic of them, and it's easy to find. I'm not sure. So I'm going to, as I mentioned, going to Igeaogic next week, and they're in a six-week experiment of only eating what they're calling native foods. The whole community is only eating food that they've grown or harvested. And so we're going to participate in that a little bit. And I'm hoping that – and all the fellows are also bringing things that are representative of their kind of region. So I'm excited to see what kind of things we get there.
That sounds like a really cool experiment. Do you have any idea of what they've been eating, like what's been on the menu?
I don't yet. I mean, a lot of things that they've grown, definitely a lot of moose and a lot of fish. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, things that we're pretty familiar with here, too.
Next time you come back, I want a full report.
Okay, yeah, definitely.
Okay, great. So the Salmon Social takes place this Friday at UAS.
Right.
Can you give us a few more details?
Yeah, so we're going to gather in the Glacier View Room, which is upstairs in Egan, at 5 o'clock. Again, there's some fish in my smoker right now that I'll bring in and probably make a venison stew of some sort. We're asking people to bring a dish, and if you don't have a dish, we'll ask that you bring a story. So part of what I want this event to do is to just create connections between the university community and in particular new students and the rest of town. And so I'm borrowing from the Salmon Project. There's lots of fishy things here. Their technology of sharing your salmon story. It's this really kind of simple, wonderful way to find connections across diverse groups of people in this state. Everybody kind of has a connection to salmon, and when you begin to tell that story, you find all these connections that you wouldn't otherwise find. Yeah, so the details from 5 to 7, we'll have some food. Mark from COPA has graciously offered to create his wonderful smoked salmon ice cream, and he'll bring that out, or I'll bring that out. And and then after if you're interested, we can stay on, and my colleague Laura Vess, who will actually be on this show tomorrow, we'll be delivering the Evening at Egan lecture, the second of the year, and it's called When the Barge Stops Running, Perceptions of Food Supply and Risk in Southeast Alaska. So trying to dovetail with a bunch of different things here.
And doing it very well, I might add.
Thank you.
I think the salmon ice cream alone is worth coming out.
Totally. If you've not had it, it sounds really weird, but it's delicious. It's like a nice mix of salt and sweet.
Yeah. I enjoy it. It's weird, but good.
Yeah.
So that's Friday night, 5 to 7, ahead of the Evening at Egan lecture, which we will hear more about tomorrow. And you don't have to tell it right now, but do you have a story you're planning on sharing?
I kind of have a set salmon story, that I've written about and talked about. And it's one of loss, unfortunately. I grew up in Washington. But I have lots of other new salmon stories through my kids. That's one thing. It's totally family friendly. I'm going to bring my two boys out. So if you have kids, bring them on out.
Great. Thanks. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I hope to see a bunch of people out there tomorrow. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Have you ever heard the song called Salmon Dance?
No.
Oh, we're going to listen to it right now.
Awesome.
Be right back after this break.
Wow. Wow.
What?
Support for this programming is paid for by Rob for Assembly, P.O. Box 32754, Juneau, Alaska, 99803. Rob Edwardson, running for District 2 for City and Borough of Juneau Assembly in the October 3rd municipal election.
The tobacco industry has led people to believe chewing tobacco is safe. They market their products to look like gum and mints and promote them in activities like baseball and hunting. The truth is, smokeless tobacco is addictive and causes oral, stomach, and pancreatic cancers. Don't be tricked by the tobacco industry. For free support quitting, call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message is brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
It is 16 minutes after the hour. You're tuned into a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and with me is my next guest, Christina Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Christina, you're here to tell us about vision boards. How much do they help with eyesight?
This is actually my second question today about that.
Just a joke. I know they have nothing to do with eyesight, but what are vision boards? Could you give us a little definition?
Yes, a vision board is when you get really clear on the things that you want to accomplish ideally in the next 1 to 5 years in your life and the things that are just really important to you surrounding your values and your goals. And then you flip through magazines or other images and you select the ones that call to you, really, that signify the things that you want to accomplish. And then you paste them on a big poster board and you post it up so you can see it every day.
Wow. What kind of magazines do people use for this?
Usually self, yoga magazines. A lot of the ladies that I work with like Oprah, workout things, Better Homes and Gardens.
National Geographic
and travel.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
That's my favorite magazine, Nat Geo. So how does the process of creating the vision board help people kind of get on the path to accomplish their goals?
Well, the process, the way that I do it is before one image is even selected or before you open up a magazine or anything, we spend a good amount of time getting clear on the things that you really want. Because a lot of times when people think of doing a vision board or a dream board, people know them as that as well, they just think about the stuff. Like, I want to have this and I want to have that and the new car and the big house and things like that. And what I found is that once we actually spend the time getting clear on their values and what's really important to them in life, the stuff kind of goes away. And then they start looking for things like, you know, more time alone and peace and health and travel and things that are just really more from the soul and not so much from like the materialistic ego side. So
right. The best things in life aren't things.
That's right.
And then how is one supposed to use the board when it's completed?
So when it's completed, a couple things about that. Just the process of getting clear, taking that time and doing that work and setting your intentions for your life or for a certain period of time is going to be valuable in and of itself. But I have found that the people who get the most benefit out of it long term are the ones that actually post it up somewhere that where they can see it every day. So it can be, you know, in an office or in a walk-in closet, the back of a bedroom door, just somewhere where they look at it a lot.
And do you have one?
Oh, yes. Oh, it's big.
Big dreams.
Big dreams.
Big visions. And it sounds like it could be something of a work of art when it's finished.
Yeah, when you look at it, you should feel good. You should feel like this is my life. You know, like you look at it and you can step into it. And I even suggest putting a picture of yourself on it and so that you see yourself right there in the middle of all of your dreams and everything that you want to accomplish.
So you're going to be organizing a workshop for creating your own vision board. What type of personality do you think tends to get the most out of something like this?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say type of personality. Someone who's open-minded and someone who believes that there's something more for them, that things are possible for them, and they're maybe feeling like they're in a rut or they've got fuzzy ideas but they're not super clear on what they want. But definitely open-minded would be number one.
Do you ever struggle when working with people who are maybe not so visual stimulation maybe isn't their thing, and mm-hmm. they tend to be more audible or something like that?
Yes, I do. And so going back to the exercises that we do before we even start the vision board, that part, sometimes that's the best thing for people. And they say, well, the vision board is just the bonus, or I don't even want to do that. I got so much out of just, you know, working through all of this stuff and coming up with, you know, what it is that I really want to do. And so that's helpful for people, just those exercises. But if like a big poster board is not the thing for somebody, then I also suggest like keeping a list, like a journal, if they can just read it every day, you know, take just a few seconds or a few minutes and just take a look at what they wrote down, then it's just as helpful.
That's a great suggestion.
Thanks.
Does this sort of thing mostly appeal to women?
No. No. No, and I always think, even now, I still think that it does. But anytime that a man hears about it, they're like, oh, and then what happens? And then what do you do? And where do you get the magazines? And so they're just as interested. And what I'm finding is that everybody has dreams, you know, everybody has goals. And so and a lot of times people just don't have the time or take the time to really sit down and think through what it is that they want and be intentional about going about the next year. And so that's men and women.
Yeah. Good answer. All right. So what are the details of your workshop coming up?
Well, it is at the Juno Yacht Club, and it's this Saturday, September 30th. And we spend a full day. I've had people say, you know, I'm coming. And then they find out that it's from 8 to 3. And then they're like, oh, I can't spend all day. And so I've been asked, you know, if I can do a shorter one. And I can't, you know, because real change takes time. And that's one of the biggest gifts that you can give yourself, is the time of really sitting down and taking the day for yourself to get clear on this stuff and then to make your board. And so it is a full day from 8 to 3. We are providing lunch, and so that's a good thing. And we're just going to start the morning with some teaching on clarity and why it's important to get clear on the things that we want in our lives, and then some reflection time, and then walking through a brief meditation, and then have the afternoon to start creating.
Is this the sort of thing that you do for a living?
I do. It's part of what I do for a living. And so it's actually my second vision board workshop. And I've done vision boards with my clients one-on-one before. And the first group one that I did was in April. And that was really great. And that's what prompted me to do another workshop.
Great. So space is limited, I understand.
Space is limited. So I've limited it to 12 people. And right now we have 2 spaces left. And so, and I reserved them because I knew I was going to have the opportunity to come today. And so I wanted to make sure that for the listeners, if people were interested, that I at least had a couple spaces left.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for doing that. I think a lot of people will be interested after hearing this interview.
So awesome.
Very smart. All right. So that's this Saturday, September 30th from 8 to 3 at the Juno Yacht Club. I'm speaking with Christina Michelle. Yes. About her vision boards workshop. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Can I say where you can register?
Oh, yes, please do.
All right. So registration, your information can be sent at www.lifecoachcm.com/events. And on that page, you can just read a little bit more information, and then you can request your invoice there, and I'll get a notification and send it to you.
Great. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. Anything else?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks for being here, and lots of luck on your workshop.
Thank you for having me.
Juno Arts and Humanities Council and KTOO Public Media proudly present Art Glasses, 8 evenings of art, community, and fun. Sip and paint, bead, craft, and more at these monthly events. Our first creative endeavor, Painted Growlers with artist Tana Peters at the Alaskan Brewing Company on October 12th and 13th from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. Supplies are included and a no-host bar. Tickets on sale now at the Jack, KTOO, or JAHC.org.
Support for this programming is paid for by Andy Hughes, 3200 Melissa Drive, Juneau 99801. Andy Hughes, running area-wide as writing candidate for City and Borough of Juneau Assembly in the October 3rd municipal election.
You're listening to A Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. And my next guest is Hal Geiger with the Foundation for End-of-Life Care. Welcome to the show, Hal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. So to begin, Hal, could you please tell us a bit about the Foundation for End-of-Life Care? What kind of services do they provide to our community?
Well, just to give you a little background, so way back in the day, we were hospice. Juneau had a volunteer hospice, and it was kind of a low-tech operation. It was before my time. But at some point, Catholic Community Services took over hospice, and then our foundation changed its name and continued on as a foundation. So we operate as a foundation. So, for example, we've spent a lot of money training hospice nurses here in town. We've bought wheelchairs for other hospices in Southeast Alaska. And so our mission really is just to kind of promote awareness of end-of-life issues and to help as we can. We've had several educational events. This one that's coming up that I'll talk about is just one in a series.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that, of course. That's why you're here. I thought we could preface it by just saying that in modern culture, conversations about end-of-life care kind of had a beginning with a few key books. Why don't you say more about that?
Well, I think if you read, there's three books that I think came along right in a row that are very interesting. One was Atua Gwandi's book, Being Mortal, and a lot of people probably know about that. Not everybody. And then the next book kind of in that series is titled, not in that series, but the next book that caught people's attention about end-of-life issues was called When Breath Becomes Air. And then the third one is this book, Extreme Measures by Jessica Zitter, and it came out last February, and I read that book. I started it probably a week after it came out, and I just thought, oh, this is really interesting. Wouldn't it be great to get her to come to Juneau and give a talk? And I got a hold of her, and to my surprise, you know, being a very busy person, she agreed to come. Earlier, we tried to get Atua Gwandi, and he has so many requests that he can't honor even a fraction of them. But Jessica Zitter was very eager to come up to Juneau, and so I'm really excited about that.
What are some of the things that she writes about that interest you so much?
Well, okay, so she's an intensive care physician in a hospital in Oakland, and she's got several pretty interesting articles in the New York Times, so people can just Google that and find them. She has a very interesting article, I think, in Atlantic about both her grandmothers and how they were dying when she was a resident. And in one case, she was able to go in and feel like her grandmother was getting septic, and she didn't feel like she was getting adequate care, and she just was assertive and banged the gong and broke the glass and pulled the switch, and indeed her grandmother was dying, and she was able to save her. But her other grandmother was really dying, and that was just a fact, and she had dementia, and I think she was very concerned that she wasn't getting the proper care for someone who really is dying. So I've kind of lost track of where I'm going with this, but I think you asked what was so interesting. Her book is really a very humble accounting of how she was trained as an intensive care physician. She just saved lives with procedures. I think she became very disillusioned with that because she felt like she wasn't really helping people. And so that she wrote this long book kind of outlining her journey from doing a lot of expensive procedures to more focus on what's really important.
So her talk is open to the public, but you also want her to address Juneau's healthcare providers. So many of them are probably listening, and you said there will be a separate talk for them.
Well, she's going to address the medical staff at Bartlett Hospital. So they're having a staff meeting. And that's one of the reasons we really want to bring her on this particular day. It's election day here. And so she's going to be giving a talk at, I think, 5. And so she'll be rushing over to the talk at Centennial Hall, which will start at 6:30. And part of the reason why I put it at 6:30, it is election day, so some people will be sticking around to vote. It's Taco Tuesday. You could go get a couple of tacos, wait a little bit, and then this thing will start at 6:30.
Yeah, good. Very good suggestion. Yeah, get those tacos.
That's what I'm going to do.
Well, why is it important for that particular audience to hear what she has to say?
Well, that particular, I mean, what we're hoping is to attract everybody, you know, representatives of everybody. But why it's important is because we're all going to face this. It's just inevitable. And I know I mentioned before we started talking, in the 1970s and 80s, people my age were very interested in taking control of childbirth. Previously, it was all this sort of industrial medicine, and the fathers just waited out in the waiting room. And I was part of that first wave of people that went into the delivery room. And we were able to do that by just being assertive and gathering some knowledge of what was of how this worked, and gathering some knowledge of how to just demand our rights, sort of. And I think that since we're all going to be affected, this is your opportunity to gather the information that you need so that you can have some control over this when this happens to your parents or your grandparents or a close friend.
And in America, I think we have one way of thinking about things. I know there are other countries in the world that maybe have a different culture surrounding end of life. Does she talk about that in her book?
I don't think that was a big part of it, but that's certainly the case. And I was just talking when I was waiting out here to come on with one of the other people about how in our culture we've lost a lot of our ritual and ceremony that has surrounded this kind of thing. And part of what's happened is just the extreme technological medicine that has just overtaken us and provided us with this end-of-life experience we have right now, which, I mean, and I know from my own experience in my family, is not necessarily good. It's not what I would want. It's not, I think, what the people who went through it would have wanted if they had expressed what they really wanted before they got sucked into it.
Very interesting. This is quite an unusual conversation afternoon.
But it is, yeah. I had a friend who said, well, isn't this kind of a morbid topic? And that's just rang in my head for a couple of years now because I thought, well, maybe, but it's a topic you were going to face. It's a topic that I faced. It's a topic we're all going to face. And ignoring it is not going to make the experience any better when it finally comes.
Well, nothing's more true when you say we are all going to face it. Maybe we don't like to think about it or talk about it, but I agree that it's important. Now, Jessica has a role in a Netflix special called The Extremist. Is that a good resource for anyone who wants an introduction to her philosophy on end-of-life care?
Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, the movie's really about her. The camera crew just follows her around, and it's not very long. I think it's 35 minutes or something like that. But this camera crew just follows her around as she works in this intensive care unit in Oakland, and she has people who come in and they say, we want you to do everything you can for my grandmother. And they don't realize what that means if what they're talking about is technology, because you see these people with their hands tied up and the tubes in the slits in their throats, and they're urinating through tubes. And that's certainly doing something, but it's not doing all that you could do to help this person at the end of life. And so I think that movie is just that is so striking because you just see it and it has more of effect than just reading about it.
So tell us the details of the talk one more time.
Okay. Yes. So the talk's going to be, again, Election Day, October 3rd. That's at 6:30 at Centennial Hall. It's free, and it's put on by the Foundation for End-of-Life Care. We've got a lot of co-sponsors, the Juno Medical Society, AARP, Bartlett Hospital. I know I'm forgetting a bunch of them. But anyway, there's several organizations that all feel this is important. So 7:30, Centennial Hall.
Oh, I have 6:30
Sorry, 6:30, okay. Centennial Hall on the 3rd. 6:30, yes.
Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, an evening with Dr. Jessica Zitter. So thank you for being here, Hal. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I don't think so. I think we covered it all. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 27th of September, 2017. It was on this date, 1825, the first steam-powered passenger railway began service in England. Train went from Shildon to Stockton, preceded by a man on horseback carrying a banner that read Periculum privatum utilitas publica, the private danger is the public good. About 600 people aboard, most of them riding in open coal cars, the dignitaries in a passenger coach, the inventor of the steam engine, George Stevenson, rode on the footplate, a brass band boarded the train at Yarm to complete the journey. It's the birthday of Jack Kerouac's girlfriend, Joyce Johnson, born New York City, 1935. She wrote a book about it, Minor Characters, A Young Woman's Coming of Age in the Beat Orbit of Jack Kerouac. She wrote, artists are nourished more by each other than by fame or by the public. To give one's work to the world is an experience of peculiar emptiness. The work goes away from the artist into a void, like a message stuck into a bottle and flung into the sea. It's the birthday of Carrie Brownstein, born in Seattle, 1974, co-founder of the punk rock band Slater Kinney and co-developer of the comedy show Portlandia, of which she said, I live in a city where fleece is considered an appropriate fabric for any event. It was on this day in 1962, Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring was published. Many scientists had published work before her that questioned the widespread use of pesticides, including DDT, but Carson gathered these reports in one place and wrote a book that people enjoyed reading. The New Yorker serialized it in the summer of 1962. It came out. It was a huge bestseller. And Carson, though she was very ill from her cancer treatments, appeared on many TV shows to promote it. Chemical companies backed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture were not fans of the book. They tried to sue Carson and her publisher, and the New Yorker spent $250,000 on a campaign calling her a hysterical woman and a communist. She died of breast cancer in April 1964, but she lived to see the book's commercial success, though not to see the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, or the Environmental Protection Agency, all of which came about due in some part to her book, Silent Spring. Here's a poem for today by Kay Ryan, Flamingo Watching. Wherever the flamingo goes, she brings a city's worth of furbelows. She seems unnatural by nature, too vivid and peculiar a structure to be pretty, and flexible to the point of oddity. Perched on those legs, anything she does seems like an act, descending on her egg or draping her head along her back. She's too exact and sinuous to convince an audience she's serious. The natural elect, they think, would be less pink, less able to relax their necks, less flamboyant in general. They privately expect that it's some poorly jointed, bland, gray animal with mitts for hands whom God protects. The poem by Kay Ryan, Flamingo Watching, from her collection The Best Of It, published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background-checked professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for this programming is provided by Maria Gladyshevsky, candidate for the CBJ Assembly in the October 3rd municipal election, paid for by Maria for Assembly.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. It is about 20... 4 minutes to the top of the hour, and I'm speaking with Dana Herndon and Taylor Vidic from Skagway Burlesque. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Say that again, Taylor.
We've also got a Cameron Brockett joining us by surprise.
Well, fantastic. Yep. Welcome to the show, Cameron. All right, Thank you. Maybe you, the three of you could introduce yourselves and tell me how you are connected to Skagway Burlesque.
I can start that, or I'm going to speak for both Cameron and I for sake of simplicity. I trust her. Taylor, that was Cameron chiming in. We are co-producing this show. We've been doing it in Skagway for the last 2 years as well. And we thought, why not get naked in our hometown?
So. Yes. Ooh, it's getting hot in here.
That's great. And I'm Dana. I've been helping the girls, boots on the ground here in Juneau, to get the place and the details locked in.
It sounds like it's going to be a killer event. But for those who have never seen or heard of burlesque, how would you describe it?
Burlesque initially started as variety acts during the Victorian period and really took a foothold here in America. They traveled circuits around America, and believe it or not, once they started throwing in exotic dance as part of these political, artistic, these variety shows, the exotic dance really hit a chord with audiences.
What?
I know. But often the the theme behind modern burlesque, which kind of started reviving later here in the 90s and the early 2000s, is the humor. So it's definitely, I mean, there's definitely striptease. It definitely is a little sexy and a little saucy. But the humor is often the main story behind it. Sometimes political humor, back to its roots, sometimes just topical humor, sometimes slapstick humor. But even though it is striptease, the humor is often what really shines in modern burlesque.
And I think Alaska has a lot of fodder for humor and jokes.
And, oh my gosh, this summer especially.
I was wondering, if you know, what's the history of burlesque in Skagway?
Well, Skagway does have a rich history of both female performance as well as female empowerment. During the Gold Rush, many women who came up here really ended up landing on their 2 feet running. Nowhere else in the U.S. could a woman own her own business, but in the territories, things were a little more loose law-wise. So many women ended up owning their own businesses, supporting their husbands even, supporting families who were living in Seattle while working up here as entrepreneurs, as performers, as incredible female powerhouses. So much song and dance, much, I would call what Cad Wilson does, burlesque. She was a performer. Taylor, do you want to tell us a little bit about a historic burlesque performer?
Oh my goodness, Cad Wilson. Both work at the Red Onion, so I get to tell this story every day, which is a pleasure. But Cad, she would do this number where she would stand up on the bar and reach down and grab her skirt, slowly lifting it up until she was revealing her very shapely ankles, which in fact, funny to get the men riled up. So they'd begin tossing money, gold up to her, and she would catch it in her skirt. But once you've got too much gold, you don't want to drop it, so you hike your skirt up more, which just continues the process until she's lifted up her whole skirt, showing them all of her bloomers and stockings without a square inch of flesh. But that was all that you needed in the Victorian era, especially during the Gold Rush, because all these men were looking at were other hairy, dirty, stinky miners. So now Artful Monty has, you know, it's changed a little bit. But again, it's not going to be anything too crazy.
That was a great story. Thank you for telling it. So we're going from the Red Onion to the Red Dog, taking the show on the road. And the big event is this weekend?
Yeah, it's Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, thank you, Dana.
And what can we expect to see if we come?
There will be a lot of sparkles. There's going to be a live band.
Oh, man.
We're bringing a few performers from Skagway that are some of the most I'm a huge fan of all of the people that we are bringing with us, as well as all the people from Juneau that are joining us. They're, again, everyone involved in the show are people that I look up to, and I think I speak for Cameron and I both. So just some excellent performers, plus the sparkle, plus the music, plus the humor. Erica Lee is going to be our host and MC, our mistress of ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And she always puts on an incredible time and has this crazy ability to pull in the room. And, yeah, just her energy, it's nuts. You will see sparkle, glamour. You'll see some ribald humor, and you will see it all performed by female powerhouses.
That sounds incredible. I'm really excited about the live band with a horn section. Mm-hmm. That really appeals to me, too.
I'm going to melt. I'm going to melt.
Well, the website's terrific. I loved the picture on the homepage. That is hot, hot, hot.
Yes.
Is that the best place to go for more information?
Absolutely. Go to skagwayburlesque.com, and we also have a Facebook event, which is Skagway Burlesque Meets Juno. So definitely check that out. We're doing little teasers, too, so you get a little sneak peek into what the performers will be doing. So if you can't go Friday, you can go Saturday. So definitely try to go one of those days and get your tickets. It's $20 for general, $40 for VIP, and if you want a table with your friends, it's $250.
Oh, fantastic. And what time does the show start?
So on Friday, it's at 9 p.m. Doors open an hour before, and on Saturday, it's 10 p.m., and it's definitely going to be a good time.
Great. Well, thank you all very much for being here. That's just about all the time we have. But is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
We are so excited to see you, Juno.
Yay! I think Juno's pretty excited, too. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
Having us!
Oh, bye!
My life, just go where the wind blows. Here comes, she caught my eye, and we made love to the moonlight. Just go where the wind blows. I know.
Yeah, all right, you're tuned into Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and my final guests are Gary Gillette and Cliff Garten, who is the artist who is responsible for the new sculpture series being installed on Juno's downtown waterfront. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. It's a real pleasure. So, Cliff Garten, you are the artist. You've done installations all over the world. They all involve lots of light and color, an incredibly dynamic design. What inspired these creations?
All the work comes out of the context of the site. So when I start the piece, I really study the site. And the program here is pretty straightforward, but it comes from several directions. You have the world coming to Juno from the ocean side, and then you have the town on the other side. And that ocean side activity is, you know, brief. A brief part of the year, and then the rest of the time it's turned over to the community. And so we really wanted to address both things because both those things make up the site. The images for the sculpture come from the natural world, which is very difficult to get away from up here because it's so powerful. And the piece is called Aquelians, which is a mashup of the Latin word for eagle and whale.
Wow.
And if you look inside the sculptures when they're up, you'll see a profile which looks like a flying bird or the fluke of a whale. And you can actually follow that form up sectionally to the top of the sculpture. It rotates up and the sculptures twist. So you'll when it's a lit, especially, you'll be able to see all those forms lit up. And then the sculpture ends in the form of a fluke of a whale's tail. So
that
you have
sounds that, incredible.
That kind of natural order imaged in the sculpture. But, you know, I think it's working here is really interesting because there's such a strong tradition of Native American art. And but yet at the same time, it's very modern. You know, the image of a cruise ship that's, you know, how many stories are they, Gary? Six?
More, 20. More like 11.
20 stories. You know, these small mini skyscrapers coming in to dock in your port. So I thought that, you know, there was a degree of abstraction that could enter into the work that really wasn't part of that, you know, regular environment that would be very appropriate here.
That's incredibly exciting to hear you describe it. I think most of us have only just seen the artist rendering. There's been a picture used in the paper a few times. It does not do it justice from the sound of it, and I'm so excited to see it in real life. You've worked all over the globe. How do you feel about making your mark here in Alaska?
Well, I love Alaska. I've always told people that the only time I ever use the word awesome is to describe the Alaskan landscape because it really fits. I've done two projects up in Anchorage about 6 years ago. I just think Alaska's amazing. You know, I love having my work here.
So these sculptures will be located on the waterfront for quite a stretch of it, from what I understand. I was wondering what materials are involved with these structures. I hope they're waterproof.
Yeah, they're waterproof. We used stainless steel. And they're made out of 3/8-inch in diameter stainless steel rods. There's over 100 rods in each sculpture. And the sculptures are designed digitally. So they're drawn in a program that, you know, allows us to create a very fluid form, but also to, you know, measure very precisely. But then all that precision, the sectional piece that I described earlier that goes up the center that the rods are welded to, is it has to be drawn very precisely. And then those pieces are laser cut. But then after that laser cutting is done, they get mounted to a series of center poles that are the structural integrity of the piece. And it's not just one pole because we want the inside to be very open, so we use a number of smaller poles. And then that's put on a kind of a spit that, you know, we can turn at the foundry and then weld the rods to each of those little notches in the sectional plates. So it's I don't know. We worked on this for about a year and a half. So the conception of the piece is, I mean, you'll see how fluid the forms are, and it looks, you know, really freeform, but it's very, very precise in its execution. But then once it's digitally drawn, then we go back to handwork. So we're really at a – with all our sculptures done in the computer, and it's all, you know, quite complex like this. And we either make them sectionally out of these rods that form the skin, or we actually will, you know, cast the forms themselves. But it's interesting because we're at a moment where we can do so much with a computer in terms of visualization, and it's what we call really gooey. It's just like working with clay. But then when you go to make that stuff, you're really back to, you know, handcraft. So when people in Juneau look at these sculptures, they should remember that every single one of those rods was hand-bent. And they go in multiple directions. So foam forms had to be made with slots in them. And then we, you know, carefully bend each rod by hand and, you know, heat them, bend them, and then fit them to these molds. And then they get welded to the sculpture.
And there's lighting involved as well.
Yeah, LED lights, which will be starting tonight. So each sculpture has four LED lights, which are capable of, you know, almost any color. And what we want to do is synchronize the 10 going down the dock in sequence of colors so that, you know, they kind of communicate with one another.
Again, incredibly exciting. And there's so much more I want to say and ask you. We are running out of time, but I understand you're giving a talk.
Yeah,
and that's tonight?
Tonight at 6.
6 o'clock, and where will that be?
At the Jack Juno Arts and Cultural Center.
Okay, so 6 p.m. at the Jack. You can hear more from Cliff Garden, the artist of the waterfront sculptures. And when can we expect to see them lighting up the waterfront? You said that starts tonight?
Yeah, we'll light a couple tonight, and then probably hopefully by Saturday, they'll all be installed.
Fantastic. That's very exciting. Again, I'm just thrilled to meet you, and I'm very happy to have you on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about your visit or your talk tonight?
No, I'll just enjoy the sculptures, and maybe I'll see you tonight.
Great. Well, thanks for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon. We had some great guests today. Tune in tomorrow. On the show, we will have Laura Vess to talk about food supply risks, and Frank Katas will be here to highlight the new production from the Juno Douglas Little Theater called Insomniacs. We'll get details about the Hasty Half Marathon, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. You've been listening to Juno Afternoon. Jeff Brown is the producer. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Have a great Juno evening.